From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Birds have had a bad rap on the intelligence front, says my guest today, Jennifer Ackerman. Bird-brained ought to be a kind of compliment. Birds are smart, very smart. Their intelligence can come close to that of primates. They build tools, navigate thousands of miles, solve puzzles, have amazing memories. This hour On Point, the genius of birds. With me now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Jennifer Ackerman, science writer. Her new book is The Genius of Birds. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer Ackerman, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. You are so good at going out into the scientific arena, gathering lots and lots and lots of information and bringing it to us in a way that's so compelling. What did you find when you began to look at the research of the last few decades on birds?
Well, you know, for a very long time, people thought birds were really driven solely by instinct and that their brains were so small and primitive that they were capable really of just very simple mental processes. But as you mentioned, we've discovered they're really much more intelligent than we ever thought. They're capable of problem solving and planning. They have these incredibly prodigious memories. They learn by example, as children do. They can recognize human faces. They can even converse in a meaningful way. And all of this is with a packet of brains so tiny it would fit inside a walnut. It's really, really remarkable.
We know, I guess we can imagine why humans, maybe in their hubris, their arrogance, might have thought that birds didn't have much going on. Bird-brained, you say, came around in the 1920s as an expression because, you know, birds were just pecking and flapping, was the idea. But even scientists, you write, looked at birds' actual brains, physical brains, and said, well, they don't have the stuff here for real intelligence. Why was that the presumption?
Well, for more than a century, we thought birds just didn't have the brain wiring that allows for intelligence. So our brains have a cortex with six layers of cells that communicate with one another. That's true for primates, too. And people thought that this layered cortex was necessary for the smart stuff to happen in a brain. And if you didn't have a cortex, you couldn't have that kind of communication between neurons that fosters intelligence. And this was based on sort of anatomical observations that go back a century. And they were very misguided. But then in the early 2000s, really, and scientists began to observe these very astounding examples of clever behavior in birds that suggested that birds seem to have intellectual abilities that are tantamount to a primate's. You know, there was Alex, the African gray parrot, who had his vocabulary of hundreds of words, and he could not only say them, but he knew what they meant. And then there was the example of Betty, the New Caledonian crow, who bent a piece of wire to make a little hook that he could pull a bucket up out of from the bottom of a plastic tube that held food. So this made scientists really rethink bird brains, that they may not have a cortex like ours, but they have a sophisticated information processing system that works like ours does. It's just arranged differently.
Could we just take those two examples for a moment? Alex the parrot. I mean, people know parrots. Parrots can be trained to speak. Again, humans, and maybe our self-satisfaction, I'm not sure, always recognize that as something that that signifies real intelligence. But you're saying Alex knew how to use the language. I've got just a little bit here. This is sound from this African gray parrot who's now sadly died at 30-some years, should have lived twice that long, I guess. But talking with his scientist and trainer, Irene Pepperberg, this was on Good Morning America. Alex, this African gray parrot, knew hundreds of words. Here's just a little bit.
I want banana. Carrot.
Good birdie.
I want corn. Soft corn.
Soft corn. Good parrot. We've got rock corn, that's dried corn, and we've got soft corn, too.
Cold.
It's cold, yes. It's cold. It's from the refrigerator.
Okay, that just sounds amazing, Jennifer. Please interpret what's going on there. Is that just a bird brain bird responding to familiar cues from a very well-known trainer, you know, who's got a patter down? Or is there a brain in there that's responding something like a human would to Irene Pepperberg?
Well, I think it's the latter. I mean, I'm not sure I'd say it was human-like, but it's very intelligent bird-like. And I just want to say, first of all, that the feat of imitating human sounds is really something in and of itself.
Very generous, first of all.
Yeah. You know, we form vowels and consonants with our lips and our tongue, and birds don't have lips.
Right.
And their tongues aren't generally used for making sounds. So parrots are unusual that they use their tongues when they're calling, and they can actually manipulate them to articulate vowel sounds, which probably underlies their ability to mimic human speech.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Alex went way beyond parroting or mimicking. You know, Irene Pepperberg could pose questions to Alex. She would intermingle different sorts of questions about objects, and Alex could answer those questions almost without fail. So she could show him a green wooden square, and he would say what color it was, what shape, and after touching it, what it was made of. So this is something that goes well beyond imitation.
Could, well, it had a vocabulary, labels, could identify objects, colors, shapes, died at 31 years of age, and his last words were his daily refrain, said to Irene, "You be good, see you tomorrow, I love you." That I don't know, I mean, That it's just so out there that I don't know what to make of it, but there's clearly something going on there. You mentioned the New Caledonian crow. This is the Southwest Pacific Island nation. Never been there. Been very close to Vanuatu. And the crow there, one of the smartest birds in the world. Here's a little sound of it. Okay, if I was walking through the jungle in New Caledonia or the forest, that would be a bird to me. I don't know that I'd know how to see or respect its intelligence. What should we know about the New Caledonian crow?
Well, the New Caledonian crow is arguably among the smartest birds on the planet. It's one of the Einsteins of the bird world. It's a very sophisticated problem solver, and it makes its own tools. You know, there are just a handful of species on the planet that make their own tools. Orangutans, chimpanzees, humans, and New Caledonian crows.
Tools like what?
Well, they have several different types. There's a tool that's just, it's actually a tool that has a hook on the end, and they are the only other species on the planet to make hook tools besides humans.
And they do this in the wild, or was this just in a laboratory setting?
No, they do it in the wild. You can find their leftover tools. They're not commonly lying around because mm-hmm. they actually reuse these tools. If they make a good one, they'll keep it and reuse it.
Right.
Yes. So the hook tool is a very useful tool for sticking into holes and snagging grubs out of the holes. The other tool that they make is very elaborate. It's made from a pandanus leaf, which is a leaf that has hooks on little spikes, really, or on the side of it. And the bird will make a tool from this that's actually stepped down, so it looks like a little handsaw or something. But it's, again, used to wheedle out these insects. And the remarkable thing, one of the many remarkable things, is that in different parts of the island, they have different styles of tool making, which they believe are passed down through the generations. And that's about as good a definition of culture as you can get.
When scientists go out to assess the intelligence of another species, I mean, what's the yardstick? We, of course, we're self-obsessed. I mean, how does one... Are we even equipped with our human intelligence to recognize the full intelligence of other species, to comprehend their full intelligence?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's not an easy task. There's a great deal of disagreement in the world of animal cognition about how whether we can measure animal intelligence and how we measure it. There's so many variables and factors involved. And we are, by nature, a very anthropocentric species. We think that our kinds of intelligence are the ones that we should be measuring.
Oh, but yeah.
The animal world is full of intelligences that are beyond our ken, and we have, I think, much harder time measuring.
So in the world of birds... is there part of what you might call their genius that we recognize and other parts that we have to actually stretch our human intelligence to see?
Absolutely. I mean, you think about something like navigation. You know, we have very limited navigational skills, and birds have very sophisticated ones.
Wait, we've got GPS. We're golden.
Yes. Yeah, but you put yourself in a situation without your GPS and without your compass.
Yeah.
the example I like to tell about this is scientists created a kind of experiment called a displacement experiment, and they plucked a small flock of white-crowned sparrows from their migratory path on the West Coast, mm-hmm. and then they transported these birds by jet 3,000 miles across the country to Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they released them. And within hours, those sparrows were beelining it solo back to where they'd been heading originally with their wintering grounds in Southern California and Mexico. Even the young ones who had only made that migratory journey once, somehow they knew just where to go and just how to get there, you know, without the help of GPS or compasses. I just don't know many humans who would pass that
test. Or JetBlue. That is mind-blowing. That is just mind-blowing. There's so much more we want to learn here. We're so happy to have you with us. Jennifer Ackerman is with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Her new book is The Genius of Birds. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org.
Waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the surprising intelligence of birds, why bird brain just might mean brilliant. The clever minds of hornbills and gulls, kingfishers, crows, grackles, parrots, pigeons. My guest is Jennifer Ackerman, science writer. Her new book is The Genius of Birds. She joins us today from Charlottesville, Virginia. Behind me right here, the sedge warbler, complex song of that warbler, recorded in 1964 in Denmark, one of the most Warbler's song, Sedge Warblers, is one of the most complex in the entire world of birds. What do you think? Have we humans defined intelligence too narrowly? Have we been a bit dull about seeing what's in front of us when it comes to birds? Jennifer Ackerman, think with us for a minute about this Sedge Warbler's song behind us and the complexity that's there.
Yes, birdsong is one of these areas of genius that I think is vastly underappreciated. The sedge warbler has a very complicated song. There are birds that have, the plain-tailed wren has a very complicated duet that's just beautifully choreographed orally. You know, Darwin said that that birdsong was the nearest analogy to human language, and I think he was right. There are remarkable similarities between the two, from the process of listening, imitating, and practicing, right down to the brain structures that are involved, and even the actions of specific genes.
I mean, we praise the genius of human musicians. Should we extend that to birds as well? And how do you decide which bird species or bird is a song genius or not?
Well, I think their songs are all unique and have genius in their own way. One of the
Is this Miles Davis behind us here? Is this John Coltrane?
In the bird world, possibly. You know, I'm very impressed with a bird that has what is really a set of calls rather than songs. The chickadee, black-capped chickadee, has one of the most complicated language systems or systems of communication in among all land animals. So they have a very sophisticated system that we just didn't appreciate. So it's not very musical, but it certainly has genius.
Let's listen a little bit, if we may, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. I want to thank the sedge warbler for coming in. That was really awesome. Here's the Black-capped Chickadee. This is recorded in 2010 in New York. You write about the high, thin whistles and complex gargle calls of chickadees. Been parsed by scientists, declared one of the most sophisticated and exacting systems of communication of any land animal. I guess a bird's a land animal. Here you go. Oh, yeah, I know that call. I didn't know what it was, but I've definitely heard that call many times.
So,
what is it about
yes.
the black-capped chickadee that draws your attention?
Well, so note the number of D's in its call at the end, because the number of those D's are conveying to other chickadees information about the size of, say you're passing a chickadee.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear this, it's indicating information about your size and the degree of threat that you represent.
Get out of here. Here comes a big honking human. He looks friendly or he's got a slingshot.
Exactly. And there was a recent study by Japanese researchers looking at great tits, and they discovered that the order of a bird's notes actually determines meaning. So this is really the first evidence in a wild animal for what's called compositional syntax. And that bird has like 10 different notes in its calls, and you play those notes in different orders and you elicit different behaviors, everything from scanning for predators to actually approaching the source of the call.
Having looked at this, how would you compare birdsong to human speech in terms of data load, which might signify intelligence?
Well, I think human language is very much more complex. But the way that we learn language and the way that birds learn their songs is very similar and in many ways equally sophisticated. It's called vocal learning, and it's very rare in the animal world. It's found in birds, maybe a few marine mammals, bats, and humans. This process involves a very careful listening for sound, imitating sound, and practicing that sound until you get it right. And it's interesting. Both birds and people have windows of learning when the brain is most easily wired for, you know, birdsong or language. So that's one of the similarities. And there are obviously differences between the features of language and birdsong, but there are more similarities than you might imagine.
Jennifer, step back for a minute. Beyond song, and for skeptics out there still thinking, bird-brained, just walk us through some of the best examples that you've collected in your book, The Genius of Birds, that give us a sense of just how much intelligence of many kinds is at work there. Give us a half dozen.
Okay. We've learned lately that birds can reason on par with small children. They can understand, for instance, that you can displace water with a stone, but you can't displace it with a little ball of styrofoam. So if you're dropping objects into a jug, that only a heavy object will work to displace the water. Now, that's on par with a child about 5 or 6 years old.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
As I mentioned, they can make these very complex navigational decisions, and they can remember where they put things using geometrical concepts. So that one of the most astonishing birds, I think, is the Clark's Nutcracker, which lives in the mountains of the western mountains of the U.S. And it's a caching bird. It stores its seeds in little seed caches, widely distributed over dozens and sometimes hundreds of miles.
Okay.
It stores about 30,000 seeds in a season in about 5,000 different places. And up to 6 months later, it can retrieve those caches from the landscape where it hid them, even though that landscape may be under snow, you know, rock and soil may have shifted.
That is incredible. 5,000 over hundreds of miles?
Yes. So I think about this every time I misplace my glasses or my keys.
And if I read you right, they also remember which seeds have been where how long, so they know perhaps what they need to get to before it goes bad.
Yes, well, that's the Western scrub jay.
It has
a variety of different food sources, including, you know, worms and insects. And so the Western scrub jay remembers what it buried where and when. And so it can return to those caches before food spoils.
Do scientists have any idea how either of these amazing feats are completed? What is the brain structure that permits them to remember 5,000 distinct locations, even under snow, over 100 miles? That sounds like supercomputer stuff.
It does. You know, the seat of memory in the brain for both humans and birds is the hippocampus. But we're just at the beginning of understanding how this can work. You know, bird brains are interesting in that they have a very high density of neurons. And so we're thinking that maybe there is, you know, some capacity within the hippocampus that gives them this tremendous ability.
I don't know. Give us more examples. These are great.
Okay. one of the interesting kinds of social intelligence is that the belief that birds can understand the mental state of another individual. Now, that's pretty sophisticated social behavior.
I have trouble with that sometimes.
Yes, exactly. There are studies of a bird called the Eurasian jay, and this is one of my favorite birds. So lots of birds share food. You know, they give food to their mates, and the Eurasian jay is one of these birds, but it's special in that it seems to understand what its mate has eaten and what that mate might feel like eating after it's had too much of one thing or another. So we're talking about waxworms and mealworms here, which are kind of the Belgian truffles of the jay world. But if a male jay is allowed to watch a female eat, say, her fill of waxworms, and then he has a choice of whether to offer her waxworms or mealworms, he'll pick the food source, the mealworms, that she hasn't just eaten. So this suggests that he understands what's going on in her mind, that he understands she has desires that are different from his own.
Yeah.
And this is called it's one of the components of theory of mind, which is the ability to understand that another mind thinks and feels and desires things that are different from your own. And it's really the foundation of empathy.
It's pretty amazing. And he could end up with a pretty good partner that way, too, treating her right.
Right.
That's just amazing. That much other awareness in the bird, the Eurasian jay delivering the Belgian truffles of the bird world to a mate or something else, if she might prefer that. Jennifer, lots of callers for you. Bill in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, this is amazing. I almost don't want to talk. The stories from the guests are amazing.
We'll get more. We'll get more. What's yours, Bill?
Well, grew up as a birder, and I have a number of interesting stories, actually, involving train ability. See, the thing about, at least to humans, we think if you could train an animal, it must be smart, like a dog.
Yeah.
I think dogs are smarter than cats, so that's a different discussion.
Oh, boy, don't get me started.
And so, you observe all sorts of neat things in the wild. For instance, one thing that we observed forever was that the chickadees and the squirrels and the chipmunks all talk to each other. That's interesting.
Like about what?
About danger. It's crazy. If you're out in the woods and a Cooper's hawk comes swooping through, you'll hear the sounds of you're like a red squirrel, you go, and then the next thing you know, you'll hear the chickadees letting off their warning cries.
Let's hear it.
And the DDD thing, and then. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing is you'll hear the chipmunks, and sure enough, the Cooper's hawk comes flying by you, and then everything's quietly leaves. You think, you know, it's interesting. They're talking. The other thing is,
yeah, but why do you think they're talking to each other? It sounds like too many Disney movies. I mean, maybe the squirrels are talking to the squirrels, and the
us before the Cooper's Hawk. It gets there before the Cooper's Hawk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've heard more than one species. So I, in other words, like I said, you'll hear the squirrel, and then you'll hear the chickadee.
Yeah, pick it
and
up.
And then later the Cooper's Hawk flies through. So you say, you know, I'm wondering if they're talking. I could be wrong.
Yeah, yeah,
anyway,
right.
So that's one thing. The other thing is trainability. And I have two major stories on that. One is my father was a bird snob. He's a birder, but a bird snob. And a bird snob is defined as someone who feels that certain birds don't really belong here. For instance, the European starling, which is true.
Uh-huh.
And so they used to come in big flocks and bother him. So he decided to get a half-a-heart trap and try trapping them. And he had a bit of a change of heart when he discovered that he could train that bird to do all kinds of things in the house.
Like what?
To fetch things and to come when called. This is a wild bird. This is not, you know, a domestic animal. This is a wild bird.
Was he sure that the bird wasn't just flapping around the living room?
Oh, no. No, it's clear. And I'll give you another example. This is a really weird one. I was at college, and one day I come out of the library, there's this crow hanging out, clearly walking around between Bomberger Hall and Mirren. And all the students are walking by, and they think it's the funniest thing. Here's this crow, and then classes are done, and it hops up, and it's on the portico. And later I tell this story to my wife's uncle, and it turns out, oh, my God, it was his crow. Now, he lived only about a half a mile away from the school. This was a wild crow that he'd essentially adopted when it had a nest failure. And this was a wild crow that they reared, and they trained, and it could do all kinds of things. It lived in a house. It would come and go as it pleased. It was wild, but it liked to live there. They trained it to do all kinds of things, and then one day it just decided to move on. So there's this crazy thing about birds where they're wild, they're trainable, and they may choose to live with you or not. And that, I just think, is fantastic sort of intelligence that there's an independence and yet an interaction with other species.
Now we've got to get Kant in here and talk about the will of birds. Bill, you've got us way out there on a wing and a prayer. Let me pick those up. Jennifer, interspecies communication, birds talking with everybody else like a Disney movie, trainability of birds as a sign of intelligence, and will?
Well, we'll start with the first one, yes. So are the animals talking to each other? I don't know, but there are many examples of birds that act as sentinels. The pied babbler in South Africa is a good example. It has a habit of feeding on the ground, and which is a dangerous place to be, especially if you're a young pied babbler. So they have sentinels who keep an eye out for predators, and the sentinel will issue an alarm call if a predator appears. Well, lots of other birds have picked up, other species of birds have picked up on the usefulness of this alarm call. So they hang out with the pied babblers, and when they hear the alarm call, they take off too.
Okay.
So there's definitely that kind of
thing
going on.
Makes it sound possible. Why wouldn't they hear the chick-chick of a squirrel or a chipmunk?
Yes, exactly. So that, you know, birds do learn from experience. And if they have heard the squirrel giving a chatter call of alarm and a predator appears, time to head out.
Jennifer Ackerman, please stand by in Charlottesville, Virginia. We are so delighted to have you with us. We could almost fly. The new book is The Genius of Birds. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We also have links there to fantastic bird cams where you can see eagles, California condors. This is On Point.
I can't stand in line at the store. The mean little people are such a bore. But it's all right if you act like a turd, because I like birds.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The amazing song of the plain-tailed wren there, recorded in Ecuador by Theodore Parker, one of the most complex bird songs in the world. Another signifier, Jennifer Ackerman, my guest today, let's say, of The Genius of Birds. That is the title of her new book. She joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Let's hear from our listeners, if we may, Jennifer. Teresa in Columbia, South Carolina. Teresa, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your last caller was talking about how chickadees can recognize the warning calls of chipmunks and squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
Recent studies into domestic chickens have found that chickens, too, can recognize the warning calls of other animals and, in fact, use that information to protect their own flocks from predators.
So even chickens, paying attention and listening to what's going on, other species around them? Okay, appreciate that, Teresa. What, one more right here, if I may. Omaha, Nebraska. Ben, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Jennifer, have you found any difference between the intelligence of birds that can fly and those that can't?
Interesting. How about it, Jennifer?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think one of the recently there was a study showing that the dodo, which everybody assumes is was the stupidest of birds, mm-hmm. could not fly, actually had a brain about the size of a pigeon. And that doesn't sound impressive, but actually pigeons are very intelligent. They have extraordinary powers of visual discrimination. You know, we were talking about trainability earlier. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Pigeons can be trained to distinguish between a Monet and a Van Gogh painting, and also between benign breast tissue in a mammogram and malignant breast tissue. They have extraordinary powers of visual discrimination, and they can be trained to make these subtle differences. So I would say that, you know, I think we sort of assume that ground birds are not as intelligent, but they are uniquely adapted to their habitats, and they have, you know, specializations that probably we don't understand.
But you do make distinctions between the cleverer birds and the ones you call not as intelligent. I mean, on the clever list, you've got grackles and raptors, woodpeckers, hornbills, gulls, kingfishers, herons, roadrunners, not to mention crows, parrots, and as you mentioned, pigeons. On the other list, the not-so-bright bulbs in the bird world, quail, ostriches, turkeys, emus, not great flyers, these.
No, that's true. And there are definitely the nitwits of the bird world.
Yeah, okay.
but you know,
next thing we know, we're going to find out that nits have some kind of intelligence. We'll have to banish that from our vocabulary. But is it just obvious that they don't have the same horsepower upstairs?
Bird power? So one of the ways that that scientists measure bird intelligence, and there are many. But one of the ways was devised by a scientist named Louis Lefebvre, and he had invented the first intelligence scale for birds. And this was based on the idea that smart birds would show innovative behavior in the wild. So he looked in the literature for examples of birds doing smart new things in the wild. How inventive was the species? Did it find new creative solutions to problems? And he did come up with a scale based on this idea. And at the top are, as you mentioned, you know, the crows, ravens, magpies, parrots, hawks, falcons, those birds. And at the bottom is the quail and the emu, which is the national bird of Australia. That caused a bit of an uproar when it was announced. The researcher names national emblem of Australia the world's stupidest bird. That didn't go over too well.
Australia up in arms.
Yes, and there are different factors that determine the size of brain in birds, whether a bird is migratory. Shapes the size of a bird brain. That's migratory birds tend to have smaller brains.
Is the size related to the intelligence?
Well, that's a very good question. We are they're still sorting that one out. But there is a correlation between this innovative behavior and the size of bird brains. So big bird brains with birds with big brains tend to be more innovative in the wild.
I don't know about emus. I guess we learned a little something here. Here's our bald eagle chatter call recorded in 2007. This happened to be in Alaska, Burrow Island. My dad just spotted a bald eagle on the home place in rural Illinois where we'd never seen one before. So I don't know if they lost their way or they're just expanding their terrain right there. I hope they know how to function in wind turbine territory. Jonathan is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hello from Wisconsin.
Hi.
Your comment was directly on point to what I wanted to ask. If birds are that smart, one of the chief arguments against wind turbines is that they will disrupt bird patterns. And again, if birds are that smart, they'll be able to figure out, hey, there's danger down that valley or on that ridge, and learn eventually to fly around it. Am I correct?
Jennifer, wind turbines, is there some way that have birds figured them out already? Are they just giant food processors? What?
Well, some birds will figure them out and some birds won't. There are species, especially migratory species, that are fairly inflexible in their behavior. And this makes them much more at risk for any kind of interference, whether it's a wind turbine or, a loss of habitat along a staging ground. That they depend on. It really depends on the bird, and some of the smart adaptable birds will definitely figure out wind turbines.
Is that inflexible behavior a sign of a lack of intelligence? After all, we humans don't keep doing stupid things, the same things over and over again and again.
Of the measures, right? When scientists are studying bird cognition in the laboratory. They often test the speed and success of the bird at solving problems in the laboratory. And, for instance, like the ability to remove obstacles to food, they ask birds to open food containers, they pulling strings, pushing caps off, pressing levers. They measure how long it takes and how readily the bird changes its tactics to solve the problem. So That is a measure of a bird's problem-solving abilities, is its willingness to sort of be flexible, try new things.
Walter in Springfield, Vermont. Walter, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yes. Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Another brilliant show in your brilliant series. God bless you for what you do. And hello, Jennifer. I wanted to comment and perhaps ask about soaring birds. I'm a glider pilot, and I get to fly around these skies in Vermont and elsewhere.
I
notice, and you notice very early, that soaring birds are very skilled at this. And if you see one circling somewhere, you can be sure that they've got the best lift in the county.
So as a glider pilot, you want to get on their trail in a way.
Exactly. Well, I was lucky enough last fall to be circling over one of our mountains here, and a bald eagle came over and joined me. And that's some of the best validation I've ever had in this activity, is to be joined up by a bald eagle who agreed that I was in some good lift.
Walter, what would you say to a listener thinking, well, that's instinct, not intelligence? Of course soaring birds are good at soaring. That's instinct.
Well, now, instinct seems to us, when we observe what they do, it seems like they have some kind of visual ability to somehow, maybe through infrared diffraction of the way their eyes work, it seems like they can see where the lift is. Because you can be sure, if you see one circling, that they're circling in the best air that there is.
Jennifer, this is just wonderful to be up there with our glider pilot, Walter, watching bald eagles, or eagles high in the sky doing the thing. What about soaring and intelligence? Have you thought about it, looked at it?
Well, I'm so interested to hear this story. It's really wonderful. I think that birds can read thermals in some way. They can understand air patterns. You know, birds can anticipate the arrival of distant storms. There's a marvelous example of this in Deborah Kramer's new book about red knots, The Narrow Edge. This is a bird that migrates 19,000 miles from Tierra del Fuego to the Arctic.
Wow.
Every year to breed, and it understands weather systems across entire ocean basins and uses that knowledge to direct its travel.
The same way we use all kinds of satellites to tell airlines where to send their jets. I mean, not the same way, but the same capacity, its own way,
right.
I guess. It's just amazing. It is just amazing. Walter, thank you so much for taking us up gliding with you for a few seconds here. Eric in Kingston Springs, Tennessee. Eric, you're on.
Yes, I was just wondering, I had heard that the hummingbirds during their migration catches rides with bigger birds. Is that true?
I don't know the answer to that question. I've heard that too. It's hard to imagine, but I don't know.
Hummingbirds perched up there like the space shuttle on a 747. I wish we did know. It's a great question, Eric. Well,
I'd like to just offer something about the hummingbird, though, yeah. which is pretty marvelous. They're another bird that really outdoes us in terms of spatial memory because they can register the location of a flower in a big, you know, featureless field mm-hmm. by visiting it once for only a few seconds. And then they'll beeline right back to that location with incredibly impressive accuracy, even if the flower isn't there any longer. And they can also remember whether or not they visited a particular flower and then gauge how long it will be before that flower refills its nectar.
Wow.
So another example of really incredible memory.
Try that sometime. We're talking about the genius of birds with Jennifer Ackerman. She's at WVTF at Radio IQ in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, here's a comment from a listener online with the Twitter handle, The Supreme Gentleman. All right. It says, genius of birds, when you consider that these birds have been making these migratory trips for thousands of years, I think you have to assume at this point that kind of stuff is hard-coded into their genes. I guess the implication is there, this is not intelligence. This is genetic. This is instinct. This is hard-wired.
Well, I think that's debatable. I think a good deal of learning goes on during migration. And a great deal of learning goes on during navigation. So birds do learn how to navigate more precisely. Those initial migratory trips when a bird is first hatched and it knows where to go. There is some genetic hardwiring going on there.
You know, a lot of people have been thinking lately, there's another wonderful book out from Franz de Waal, this Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And she's saying it's really a lot about how we've been so focused on our own intelligence that we've sort of been willing to dismiss. She says, think about it. How likely is it that the immense richness of nature fits on a single dimension? Isn't it more likely that each animal has its own cognition, adapted to its own senses and natural history? What have you thought about your own human intelligence, looking at the intelligence of birds and our capacity to really appreciate the intelligence of other species, Jennifer?
Yes, you know, I couldn't agree more with de Waal. You know, our mental abilities, like those of every other creature on the planet, are the product of evolution over a long time, and they have their roots in evolutionary precedence. So we share a surprising amount of biology with other creatures, you know, including birds. And we also share similar challenges in getting along in the world. And in some cases, we've come up with similar solutions, whether they're biological or cognitive and behavioral. So, you know, I think more and more research is showing that the behavior that we thought was uniquely human, you know, planning, problem solving, reasoning, learning, teaching, empathizing, grieving, these things are shared by other organisms and really used in their own unique ways.
A little sound of the bittern recorded in Norfolk, England. Behind us, that deep booming call. You write, songbirds learn their songs the way we learn languages, and pass these tunes along in a rich cultural tradition that began tens of millions of years ago. That is some sound, and you acknowledge learning there. Jennifer, it's been terrific talking with you. This has really been a lot of fun. I want to thank you so much. The Genius of Birds is the new book. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You're terrific. Can't wait to see what you dig into next. Thank you so much for bringing us this one, Jennifer. You've got us, bird brain has a whole new meaning to us now. Genius.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you here. The Genius of Birds. We'll go with Bobby Day, Rockin' Robin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Caroline Bechtel and Maeve Pages. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman, and that's The Flock. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Well, the pretty little raven at the Birdman stand taught him how to do the bop, and it was grand. They started going steady and bless my soul. He out-bopped the buzzard and the Oreo. He rocks in the treetop all the day long, hopping and a-bopping and a-singing his song. All the little birds on Jaybird Street talk to hear the robin go tweet, tweet, tweet. Rockin' Robin, tweet, tweet, rock, rock, rockin' Robin, tweet, tweet, tweet. Low rockin' Robin, country's really gonna rock tonight.